Hello. Welcome to the Therapy Thursday podcast. I'm your host, Kelly Yu, and every single Thursday, I learn lessons from my own therapy sessions and I share them with all of you. I'm so ready to go through and grow through so much with you. Let's go. I always try my absolute best to create a safe, inviting space to talk about all the things we never want to talk about, whether it's my own personal family trauma, my very bad string of breakups, my continuous IBS constipation struggle, or my period health. I'm diving into these conversations unapologetically. And that's why I'm so thankful to have a sponsor like DivaCup supporting our podcast. I ditched the disposable tampons and pads and finally switched to the Diva Cup in January of 2020, and I have never looked back. Ugh, truly the best period decision ever. My Diva Cup is a reusable menstruation cup made from 100% medical grade silicone. It's a durable, healthy, waste-free option for your period. Diva Cup is changing the way we talk about periods. They're so passionate about sustainability, equality, and fighting the stigma associated with menstruation. And I couldn't be more proud to have them as a sponsor on our first season. Can't wait to share with you more about my experiences with Diva Cup and their amazing line of products. So head to the episode description to find out more about Diva Cup and follow along on Instagram at the Diva Cup. I really hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Whitney.
Hello.
Oh, welcome to the Therapy Thursday podcast. I am so grateful to have you, one of the most inspiring therapists that I have looked up to for so long here. How are you feeling today?
Thank you so much for having me. I am good. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, please. Okay, everyone. I told Whitney what we do during the show are, oh, please. So Whitney, can you tell us anything that's made you go, oh, please, this week?
Yes. I am 38 weeks pregnant, and someone asked me if I had an 18-wheeler truck to remove my baby.
What?
And told me I was huge. So to that, I'm saying, oh, please.
Wait, are you kidding? What?
True story.
Where? How?
Yeah, it was actually a doctor. It's very fascinating. We could dive into a whole episode on pregnancy and weight, from what I've learned. But
oh, please, he or she or that person, they need to be quiet. That is absolutely insane. I'm so sorry. But oh my gosh, baby, so happy for you.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, you know what? Oh, okay. Here, since we're just talking about, we're going to get into a lot of therapy talk. Don't worry, everyone. We're going to get into it. But my oh, please today is, I think when a lot of people really do bond over just analyzing people's bodies and looks. And because there are so many of those Instagram accounts that are like, oh, look at this person's plastic surgery and stuff. I think it is super cool that we kind of lift that veil because it helps people know, you know, this isn't real. But oh, please, with the constant talking about it and sharing it between friends. Mm-hmm. I have a friend that constantly wants to talk about it. And I just go, even though we're lifting the veil and reminding ourselves we are beautiful the way we are, we're still talking negatively about people.
So true.
Well, I have to let you know, we are getting to talk to the incredible, inspiring, and ridiculously insightful Whitney Goodman, licensed marriage and family therapist, and you specialize in trauma, relationship issues, and couples therapy. Oh, I just love that trifecta right there.
Thank you. Yes, it definitely keeps things interesting.
And it really is. It makes sense for all of those to be connected. And I, for one, have gone through all of those and have done all of them. I know I'm only 27, but couples therapy happened, I think, when I was 25.
Good for you. I think Thanks. That's great.
Yeah. Well, it helped me get out of it, which is fascinating. But I'm so nosy, first of all, and always just so fascinated to know how therapists became therapists. So can I ask you what made you want to do this?
Yeah, I think I've always kind of been a pseudo fake therapist to like my family, my friends, which is how most of us get started, I guess. And I was graduating from undergrad with a degree in sociology, which was pretty worthless at the time.
I don't think I've ever even taken a sociology course.
Yeah, I don't know why my parents weren't like, hey, you might want to think about this. They just like let me get to the end. So I was thinking, you know, I should probably go to grad school because I can't get a job.
Wow.
And I started Googling programs. I was like, oh, this really sounds like something I want to do. I applied and I went straight from grad school. Straight from undergrad. So I've been practicing as a therapist since I got out of grad school. I haven't really had any other professional careers.
Wow.
And I love it. So I'm glad that I made the right choice at that age.
You really did, because, oh, that's so interesting too, that it was just something, once you saw it, you felt boosted, and probably because of your own personal experiences, but that was a pretty brave leap.
Yeah, I always wanted to work with people. I did a lot of like volunteering, things like that. I kind of wanted to be a teacher, but I'm glad I went with this instead. It's been very fitting for me.
Oh, well, we are so lucky, because the reason why I've always really gravitated you for years, and so many people do, is you really have made me feel very seen, but also validated. When you speak on things, specifically family and relationship difficulties that most of us have learned and have trained ourselves at this point to really bury. And when I think about that tremendous skill of burying things, like the coping mechanism of burying, do you feel like that really stems from family?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's something we learn as children, right? Mm-hmm. To keep things hidden, secret, push them down. I mean, that's very cultural, family oriented. We learn that from watching our parents, siblings, etc.
Yeah. Do you feel like when you were growing up, there was a lot of talk about genuinely checking in deeply with how are you doing, how are you feeling, and also here's the kicker: how do you feel about our family dynamic?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, right.
It's such a new thing that now I notice people in my family are doing it more. And I think it's because I'm doing it publicly and it's something that we talk about now. But when I was growing up, I don't know that so many people were doing that. I don't think it was like my parents purposefully trying. They just kind of didn't know you were supposed to.
Oh, 100%. And especially my parents are Asian, and we all know that their parents had never even said, you know, anything nice, realistically. And so did you gain a skill of kind of hiding a lot of maybe even feedback you wanted to give your parents on how you were feeling? Did you ever see any, like, how did you learn that there might be family dynamics and stuff that aren't happening that you wish they were in your family?
I definitely learned that in school and also just being around other families. I think when I went away to college, I was like, oh, families are different from mine in a lot of ways. And they're not all the same. And you start getting around other people's parents and their dynamics, and you realize like there are so many ways of interacting with one another. Mm-hmm. And I think when we're growing up, we kind of feel like our family is the way that everybody else's is, or that there's nothing different out there.
That was so scary for me, because I was so used to obviously how my family was. You know, we didn't talk about any feelings, and there was one family member in particular that I really always did have this gut feeling of I don't understand them. I don't know why they treat us this way. You know, they're so nice to everyone else except for inside the family. And I was never allowed to give any feedback on if they've hurt my feelings, if something they're bothering me. And a lot of Asian cultures have this, you better just respect me and don't talk about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that can be scary to internalize that as a kid and be like, wait, why can't I talk about this? Mm-hmm. And why is nobody else talking about this?
Yeah. You really gain these three skills, I think, is one, walking on eggshells. Mm-hmm. Two, every time you walk into the room, you take the temperature. And then three, you turn into a shapeshifter for other people's comfort. How do you go about helping clients even see that? I think that's even the biggest step before trying to help them work through it. A lot of us cannot even sense that we do that yet.
Absolutely. I mean, when somebody decides to come to therapy, I think that they have kind of like an inkling that that's going on. They're looking for it to be validated and pointed out to them, versus someone who's not in therapy and maybe really isn't seeing that mm-hmm. yet. So I first try to just like even get a history and hear how their dynamics are. And when I feel like they're ready, I can point out like, what was that like when they did this? Did you feel like that was normal? You know, was it uncomfortable? And trying to get them to identify those patterns versus me just calling it out and saying, well, that wasn't right.
Well, I know I when you are even saying this is how you go on your process. Oh, I remember not even wanting my therapist to ask me those questions. Do you ever feel like your clients are not wanting you to even prompt that? Because sure, when we go to therapy, we're starting to want to work on it. But I think the family stuff is just the most sensitive button for me.
Absolutely. And some people come to therapy with this like individualistic mindset of like, I'm working on my issue. There's nothing else impacting me. And it's like, why do you want to talk about my dad or my mom? Like that has nothing to do with this. And I, of course, see everything through that lens because I am a family therapist. And I have to ask those questions. I think they're very important.
I'm just laughing because it's like, wait, were you my therapist? Are you just recalling everything I've said to you? Because word for word, it's like, I'm sorry, I came here to talk about my binge eating, came here to talk about my boyfriend that I kind of hate. So why are you asking about my dad? Like, I just don't, I'm really offended and I'm going to shut down now. How do you open up? The shutting down is an automatic response for, I think for me in the beginning, even 3 years, I've been going to therapy for 6 years. Mm-hmm. How do you so gently open that tight clam of a person when you really hit those spots?
It takes time. You know, if somebody's really not ready to talk about something, I'm not going to push it that hard because yeah. I think that just furthers the clamping down and the disengagement. So it's better to go back to like, okay, let's talk about what you want to talk about. And I know that eventually the road is going to lead where it needs to go.
You know, I just think that's so amazing, Whitney, because you are also just a human being. And as a therapist, you're truly only there in that moment to hold space for them. And it's all about them. And I just feel so fascinated by you really just have to do whatever this person needs. And I'm interested to know, because I am a recovering codependent. And I know a lot of recovering codependents become therapists. How do you care for yourself in a session? I know it's not about you, but still, like, It's an interesting situation.
Totally. For me, the biggest hurdle to get over was that I was very like by the book at the beginning and wanted to get the results. Mm-hmm. And so now after some years in the field, I'm more able to just like sit back and not get so tied to the outcome or the performance of the client. And that's mm-hmm. been the most, you know, life-changing thing for me. And I think for my clients is just to be able to say like, you know, today we didn't get to that and that's okay.
Wow. That's some real self-care for you.
It definitely helps.
Because you do care about them and it is actually very so brave and healthy for you to want to take that step back and constantly remind yourself of that. One thing that I think a lot of us tend to always try to figure out things we don't want or red flags or things that could be negative. But I'm kind of curious as to how in families, like you had said earlier, a lot of us do think, oh, my family is just kind of the way it is. And you really just swallow it and you accept it. But what should a healthy parent-child relationship kind of feel like? And like, if you're having a discourse or an argument, I think a lot of us have just never been able to fully flesh out that a healthy argument.
Yeah. So I mainly work with adult children and parents. So I'll mm-hmm. speak to that dynamic, but I think the basics need to be there, right? A genuine attitude of respect, mm-hmm. being able to hear one another out, trying to take breaks if needed, of course, like no name calling, no typical markers of abuse, of course, no physical altercations, and trying to meet at this common goal of like, we want to have a relationship together. So how can we make that happen?
Mm. That teamwork element is often so missing, because if the parent doesn't have the skill to be able to be super empathetic like they should, even though the word should is operative too, because they haven't been taught as well. But it's so hard when you're fighting with anyone, for that matter, having a heated discourse, to remember you are wanting to build a connection.
Absolutely. And I think with some parents, you know, especially in certain cultures, I know you mentioned like in Asian culture, in Hispanic cultures, there's sort of this feeling of like, respect your elders and like, I am your parent, regardless of how you feel. And yep. When children are adults, it does become more of a teamwork. Now, I believe like the parent's always the parent and the child's always the child.
Yeah.
But that adult child is a fully functioning, independent human that needs to have their needs and wishes respected. It can't just always defer to the parent because they know best, because oftentimes they don't.
Oh, and that's what, oh my gosh. Okay. What you just said is what has breeded so much confusion in my family. Specifically, you know, my dad was really the one who was like, I'm the parent. You're just going to listen to what I say. And as I've gotten older, it did switch to him viewing me as an adult that wants respect. But then sometimes a parent can often shift to no longer understanding you're still the child. There still needs to be enough offering and warmth. Do you ever see that? How do you work on that, communicating I need both? Because I've really just said to my dad, you know, I'm the kid and I need you to be the parent.
Yeah, and that can be confusing for parents, right? It's like, how am I supposed to treat you as an adult but also as a child?
Yeah.
It's a new dynamic. And I think we can have like some grace for the parents as well in that space.
Yeah.
But really communicating that like, I look to you for as a secure base in life, even though I'm an adult. So the same as when you were a child, like I look to you for security, for comfort, for empathy, understanding. And I also have my own beliefs, ideas, and things that I want to say to you because I'm an adult.
Yeah. And not being able to practice and learn that with family members, I think really, really hurts us in a lot of ways when we try to have healthy relationships with our peers and friends and partners. Do you see that a lot in your clients, kind of, you know, that very typical recreating some dynamics that haven't been sorted through quite yet when it comes to family?
For sure. It definitely happens. And sometimes it shows up in ways that are not so predictable. Mm-hmm. Or like, this woman appears exactly like your mother or your father. But you can see that the person is interacting with them much in a similar way.
Right. And I think in the ways that we have learned to receive love and give love, or whatever versions of love that we have had that might not even be healthy love or connection, that is, I think, what showed me in my life, oh, I'm recreating this, because the people I've dated, nothing like any of my parents, but the way we interacted couldn't be more similar.
Exactly. And I think that's where people get confused, like with the whole like, oh, you marry your mother.
See, I hate that.
Just like, they're just like your father. And like a lot of times they may not actually present very similarly, but they bring out the same traits in you.
Yes. And that's what ties it back to, I just cannot stand even my old self of the way a lot of times we can learn how to get out of really toxic, unhealthy relationships is often pointing the finger. Because that is kind of what needs to help you get away. But how scary, but then so peaceful is it to realize, oh, I was so toxic.
Right. And admitting that is hard. Yeah. You know, I think a lot of people, like you said, do want to point the finger and not look at. And in some cases, yes, that's what's happening.
Totally.
But there are situations where you're both contributing and the dynamic just gets worse and worse.
I like what you said, contributing. It is a... Nothing becomes the way it is if you're not at least participating. It doesn't mean that you're making it happen.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. You're still showing up and being present in the relationship for whatever reason.
Yeah. And can you explain to, so, you know, I think when we say, I often say this to myself, well, it was working. What do you think really keeps people constantly wanting it to work? And what does it mean when I say, you know, even if it's toxic and unhealthy and they absolutely hate it every single day, what do you think keeps them there just constantly running on that wheel?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of different reasons, but I think it all boils down to this thing of like, it's going to be different. There's this hope that's attached to the relationship. And that might be that I'm going to finally like fix this person. I'm going to get what I want from them. A lot of these types of relationships are like roller coasters with peaks and valleys, and those peaks keep you in and they keep you engaged.
I know. And I think that's often what we saw with maybe our parents or the way that it happened in our family. I know for me, I was so used to hot, cold, night and day, left and right, don't know where we're going.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of messages from culture, religion, et cetera, that say like, you're supposed to stick things out. You stay by people. You know, we hear a lot of these beliefs that sort of tell us, even if things are horrible, we should stick around because eventually they'll get better, or it's just our duty to stay.
Oh, I know. And when you are talking to clients and kind of just gauging, you know, what was it like? How did you feel when this happened? Or what was the dynamic like with this family member? How do you, I know there's a lot of situations where my therapist would start to inch me towards considering maybe putting up some boundaries, maybe not talking to them as much, maybe not seeing them as much. How scary is that for some clients who are really close to their families, even though they feel kind of tormented by the connection?
It's extremely scary. And I come from the belief of like, the client leads what they want. So if you are not at a place where you feel like you want to have boundaries with that family member, even if I think it's going to make your life much better, it's not something that I'm going to impose. If the client is open to saying, you know, I think I need to kind of take some space, then that's something we're going to talk about. Or they're asking like, how can I make this more manageable, then boundaries would absolutely be discussed.
Yeah. Can you give us some examples of boundaries and ones that feel kind of easy to begin with? And also, I know that a lot of us see boundaries as walls and brick walls that keep people out, but they really just allow you to keep your sense of self and know what you think and what you feel. And it kind of shows people how you want to be treated. And how does one person start to practice that with family?
Yeah, what I see a lot in something I did in my own personal life was like either setting these really strong boundaries that were like too extreme for me to enforce, or really loose boundaries that made me resentful. And so I like to start with, like you said, some easy ones that might be as simple as like, I don't stay as long as like I normally would when I'm at a family event, or I don't answer the phone when my mom calls if I'm not able to talk to her. Like really trying to just think about these little things that we can do throughout the day that preserve our peace more. And then as you work on those, I think it's much easier to introduce stronger boundaries of like, you know, I'm not going to be around you if you're under the influence of drugs or alcohol or whatever it may be.
Ooh, I really love those, because when you mentioned the one, especially about not staying as long, or if I don't feel like it, not telling myself I'm obligated to talk, I realized too that one of the biggest services of a boundary is that you don't do things you don't want to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How did we get to a place where we always just end up doing things we don't want to do?
I know. Well, that's part of that conditioning too, right? As kids of like, you honor your parents, you do what they say, or your family members. And it's sort of like we're walking on this tightrope of like, if I don't do everything this person wants, they're not going to love me. They're going to reject me. They won't accept me. But really, you're just making yourself miserable.
I know. There's so much of that. And when you build that relationship with yourself. That's what causes a lot of the self-blame that you jump to first. Your brain no longer wants to consider that it could be a crack in the foundation of your relationship or something that has to do with the other person. I think that's what got me to really think everything's probably my fault.
Right, right. And it's interesting that I have some clients, people that I've worked with in the past about on boundaries and feeling like this relationship's going to end if I stop performing. They're not going to love me. And I think they're really surprised at how often that doesn't happen. Now, of course, there are extreme situations of abuse or, you know, people with personality disorders that might be might actually withhold that love. But in some situations, the family member does adjust and the relationship isn't severed because you didn't stay an extra hour at that family event.
Oh, so much really is based in fear. We don't want to change for fear of them not wanting to come with us.
Exactly, exactly. And fear of being rejected by them.
Yeah, because like you said, family base, you don't feel okay without it. And most of us, even if you have it or you don't, still struggle with feeling very secure in that, even if on the outside, it looks like you have such a great family. And my biggest struggle was I think obviously you're a therapist, so you'll understand what I'm going to say, but I had so much verbal validation, like, I love you. You're so important to me. I love you. I love you. I'm here for you. Always. I care about you so much. You're my 1,000,000%. I am, you know, I'm here for you. But the actions were so different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that can be extremely confusing and often make you feel like it's in your head.
Oh,
because
yeah.
The words are there. And so there is evidence. You know, that there's like effort being made, but you don't see it actually playing out.
Well, and that's where also the gaslighting comes in from the person that's doing that. But also, I think I really learned how to gaslight myself.
Totally. That's extremely common.
How do you get someone to get out of the pattern of a lot of the self-guilt, self-inflicted blame when they're so used to having that learned behavior of manipulating themselves to think that everything's okay, but it's all their fault.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I use the approach that anything that has been learned can be unlearned and relearned in a different way. Mm. And so I like to first figure out, like, where did you learn this? Because you weren't born thinking this way. So who taught you that? You know, what purpose is it serving in your life? And what do you think it's keeping you safe from or protecting you from? Because that's a lot of what it is. You brought up fear. And like, mm-hmm. when we do these things, most of the time it's because we're trying to avoid some type of outcome. And often the way we're going about that avoidance is not helpful.
You said it right. The avoiding of seeing a lot of truths is a way to kind of protect that family system too.
Mm-hmm.
So when I learned about family systems, I actually first heard it from Vienna Farren,
mm-hmm.
Who's Mindful MFT, I believe, on Instagram. I saw her do a talk, and I was crying during this talk. And it just went to show me, this was 2 years ago, and I was in such a different place. And it's because I was just learning so much of this. I'd never heard someone say the phrase family system. And can you kind of talk to us about how family systems work and each family member kind of does play a role in how we struggle and kind of feel trapped in those roles after a certain time when we realize things?
Yeah, you can look at the family system as being like a cell, right? And everybody's contributing and working together to maintain homeostasis or like this balance within the cell. Mm-hmm. And that homeostasis or that like normalcy for the family isn't always good, but it's the role that everybody knows how to play. And so it's very familiar. And what often happens is, let's say, like in your family, when you started to notice that, hey, things aren't really right here, or like I'm not comfortable in my role anymore, if you start to shake up what you're doing, it kind of like ricochets mm-hmm. to all the other members. And a lot of them might be like, oh, heck no, we are not changing what we're doing. Like, I'm comfortable like this. Some might want to change with you, but overall it creates this really like serious discomfort within the family when somebody decides to change or set a boundary. And that's when we see like the feeling in that cell or the way it's operating start to change, and it can take some time to get it back to a good place.
Oh, so much time. And something that is a little bit frustrating for me is social media is so good about say the no and put up the boundary. But actually, from my personal experience, the most painful part was actually realizing I wanted to open up those doors again. And it was terrifying because I had finally mastered being able to no longer talk for a while and not pick up calls and say, hey, I just really don't want to talk. I'm healing. And it took me years to get to a place where my therapist finally helped me to feel confident in, if I don't do this, I'm probably going to hate this person forever. Mm-hmm. I do need to actually take time away because I don't want to be mad at them forever. And I don't think a lot of us understand that boundaries actually help you deal with the resentments. You can become closer.
Exactly. I think that's, you bring up a really good point about like the conversation about boundaries on social media, mm-hmm. that I think it kind of gets cut off sometimes as like, you just end the relationship with this person and then you're going to feel better and they're not going to have any more influence on your life. And I think I posted about this yesterday that like, that's the cutoff is just the first step. And yes. If it's somebody that's abusive, if it's somebody that has had a really detrimental effect on your life, they may never come back into your life. But it could also be someone like you or me or anybody else that thinks, you know what, I do want to get to a place where I have this person in my life in a certain way.
Yeah.
Maybe not like it was before. And we have to talk about that opening up process again, because it is really terrifying. I think sometimes it's harder than setting the boundary.
Oh, it is so much harder, because I still think a lot of setting a boundary is reactive, because it's kind of like a delayed response to something you've been wanting to do for a long, long time, or you've been needing.
For sure. For sure.
And I think when you get to a place where you realize, for example, I'll just talk from my own experience, it was really painful not having a connection with my parents, because historically I've been just best friends with both of them. And then when you learn, oh my gosh, all these things have caused me to be in like a 7-year-long narcissistically abusive relationship. Interesting. It took me a long time to just have to look at all those pieces. And I tell you all, it for me personally was not possible without therapy, because I didn't want to go there and realize a lot of stuff. And who wants to not be able to talk to their parents? Like you said, Whitney, when we don't have that family base, it can be, I felt completely lost in my life for like a year.
Absolutely. And that's what I think a lot of people have, this mindset of like, I'm going to cut them out. I'm going to be so strong and tough, mm-hmm. not going to miss them. My life's going to be great. And yeah. when it comes to the family, like especially parents, we are, you know, biologically programmed to seek out our parents and to want their approval, even when they're not good to us.
Yes. And like you mentioned so well, is that a lot of times abusive people or people who are just so not wanting to change, yeah, they won't change. But Whitney, I tell you, I cannot believe they have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And not in perfect ways, but here's the biggest change I think a lot of us don't realize is the most significant is they actually do listen now.
Right, right.
We might not be able to get them to say everything we want, but are they hearing you? That is a huge goal. We forget that maybe that'll fill a lot of the gaps for us.
Mm-hmm. And that process of being open to somebody changing and trying it out is extremely vulnerable. And I think for some people, it's easier to just say, they'll never change. I'm keeping them out of my life forever. And that is true in certain situations. But in others, I find you get such a big gift when you're able to go back and kind of allow them to meet you in this new place.
That's true, because they will not be able to also know what you need if you've never said it.
Right, right.
And also, most of the times when we are communicating what we want and need, It's in a yelling situation.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get ourselves to a place of calming down when you're super, super heated with someone that you love and you just can't see that you like them at all at that point?
I think first figuring out like what are the signs that you're dysregulated in a conversation is the best thing you can learn, because then you can use that with anybody. So if you know that, you know, your heart starts beating faster, you like shut down, whatever it is, that's when you know you need to take a break or not start an intense conversation in that moment. And when you know those signs for yourself, that's huge. And you can always kind of call a timeout.
It really is a lot of the whole, you got to connect with yourself to know how you want to interact.
Exactly. Yep. And you have to show up as the person that you want to be, you know, and how you want other people to treat you as well.
Yeah. And right there, what you said right now was what was really scary about when I started to realize, oh, I want to let my parents back in, because I did want to just be this warrior woman who finally gained the skill of having a boundary. And I think when you have struggled with self-identity a lot in your life, you really latch on to the new skill you've gotten.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it feels good to be like tough and to set boundaries. There's a lot of power in that.
It is. And when a client comes to you and it has practiced these boundaries and then is ready to open up, what are some of the things and in the small ways that you've helped them, guide them in a way to do it where they still feel that same sense of confidence? Like, okay, this is who you are now. And just because you open up to them, it doesn't mean that you're not.
Exactly. So I usually suggest moving very slowly, and coming up with maybe some situations that would be comfortable. So for some people, that's like, I'm going to start maybe texting with them, or having a phone call, going to lunch, like not just jumping right back into a relationship, but trying to come back in these slow ways. And also making it very clear, like, I'm coming back with these expectations and letting the person know, you know, what you want the relationship to look like. Like you mentioned, they don't know. They don't know what you've been doing in this healing time that you've taken.
Oh, that's so true.
Communicated that.
Oh, that's so true. It's very vulnerable to let people in to know how you've been crying and missing them. Because I think I was afraid of saying that too, but it felt so good to say when I said, no, I know we haven't talked in a long time, but I've missed you every day. And it's hard to explain that.
Yeah, especially to somebody that's hurt you, because you're opening yourself up again to that potential hurt. And I think that's what we have to decide is like, is this relationship worth pursuing to possibly get let down again? And there are some that aren't, and some like maybe with a parent or somebody that you want to have a relationship that you say like, you know what, I'm in a place where if they can't meet me where I am, I have the tools to handle it, but I'm going to give this another shot.
Yeah. And it is so important that I took the time to decide before jumping into even small steps to know, what do I actually want?
Mm-hmm.
Because when you've had fuzzy relationships, not even with family, anyone, with friend breakups, if you're not sure you even really want to be friends with them again, you might need more time.
Absolutely. And sometimes when you just do one of these mini like interactions, it gives you a sense of like where the other person is at and where you're at. And just because you open the door slightly doesn't mean you need to like swing it wide open and have a full relationship with this person. It can be just a test or dipping your toe in the pool.
Oh, that's so true. Oh, okay. Here's a situation where, so when you decide, oh no, I really want to build a relationship with them, and then you end up doing one of these small toe dippings and the person doesn't really show any signs of them having grown at all or meeting you halfway, Whitney, please tell us how you encourage clients to take that data in, like really let that sink in.
Right. So take it for what it is. You know, if you're looking at the other person, you're like, wow, they are exactly who I left. You know, whether it's a friend, romantic relationship, et cetera, then that might be a sign of like, this isn't the right time. to go back to it. It's also worth evaluating, like, do I need to let this person know, like we said, what I'm looking for in a relationship and what my non-negotiables are, and see if they're
non-negotiables
willing to meet me there.
What are some non-negotiables that we so easily find to be totally fine, just thrown out the window? Like, what are some typical ones that you often see? Because I know I didn't even know what a list of non-negotiables was until I finally got out of my very long-term relationship. I'd never heard of that before.
Right. So I think it can be anything, but a lot of the ones that I see are around like communication and time. So maybe like, I don't want to have conversations where we yell at each other or where there's name calling, or I can't be available to you all the time. Like, this is how I'm going to be responsive to you. And trying to make sure that you set those boundaries from the start of opening up a relationship, because it is very easy to slip back in to the same old dynamic.
Oh, it totally is. Oh, and there's a lot of times I see one of the biggest struggles in being able to kind of end things or step away from things is when people are struggling. You know, I've actually dated people with addiction, personality disorder, deep, deep struggles. And I was such a codependent empath type of person for a lot of that time. So I felt like if I left, it was me abandoning them. But one thing that my therapist really helped me realize is, just because someone has issues doesn't mean you have to stay or you have to go. It just depends on how your issues and their issues puzzle up or no.
Right, right. And also, staying with someone sometimes when they're struggling can be more of an act of enabling than helping. And so figuring out, like, how can I actually help this person in a way that's going to be beneficial to them? And not just feel good to me, because sometimes we stick around because we think that the person needs us. And in reality, we just want to be the one to help them.
Oh, hell yeah. It's like, oh, you need me? Oh, that feels so nice. And
yeah, of course. Love
Whitney.
That.
That's hilarious. Hi, everyone. I know for me, sustainability can be so overwhelming, and I don't talk about this as often because I'm working on it in my everyday life, but sometimes I just don't know where to start. Like, yes, hello, of course I want to do my part for Mother Nature.
Oh, Kelly, so true. I have found my own journey to be more eco-conscious. It's exactly what you just said. It's through my everyday actions, and that has been the easiest step for me. So recently, I actually bought a water filter for my fridge to replace all those gross plastic bottles. And this one might kind of sound random, but I removed all the paper napkins from my kitchen. So it's just the little things for me right now.
Oh my gosh, Danny, that's exactly it for me. My friend Nathan came to visit me for a couple days, and he was blown away by the fact that I had no napkins, no paper towels, or even tissues. And that's okay. Here's the thing. It's because my mom taught me to use paper towel to blow my nose as a kid, and that just really stuck with me. And since switching from tampons and pads to my reusable Diva Cup in January 2020, I've been practicing sustainability down there. Danny, isn't that wild?
Yeah, it is wild. And because it's made from 100% medical grade silicone, it's a healthy and durable option every month. And beyond being reusable, they have launched a pretty incredible recycling program with TerraCycle. So through Diva Recycles, Diva Cup users are actually able to fully recycle their Diva Cups and Diva Wipes packaging. So having a reusable, sustainable option for your period every month can make you feel so much better about your sustainability goals.
Ooh, we love to hear it, and we love to see that action. If you are looking to make a sustainable shift for your period, head to the episode description to read more about Diva Recycles and why using a Diva Cup may be the perfect solution for your menstrual cycle. Be sure to follow along with @thedivacup on Instagram to hear more sustainability and menstrual equity news. Okay, I have some great listener questions for you. Can we power through some of them?
Yeah, let's do it.
Vent here. This is the part of the show where we react to your vents, and I absolutely love giving you all the space to share what you're feeling, what you're going through right now, anything that might be bugging you, or something really cool that's gone on in your life. We are going to react and respond right now. All right, first one. I feel like I need to go to therapy, but I'm afraid of the first step and I'm afraid of my family overhearing my conversations. You know, I'm assuming it's probably during COVID times still when they're at home or...
Okay, so the first step of therapy can be challenging. I would try to break it down as small as possible. So maybe just saying like, I'm going to start Googling some names. I don't need to call anybody yet. Or I'm going to ask for recommendations. And then the next step is going to be, I'm going to reach out. An email might be easier than calling and trying to just work yourself up slowly to that initial consult. As far as privacy goes, that's tough. I mean, I have clients take theirs from like the closet or the bathroom or their car, going somewhere that's private away from your family, if at all possible. It should be private.
Yeah, I've done, last year I did a trauma support group therapy and a couple of the other people in my support group were in their cars. And I was like, oh, that's smart.
Yeah. The car is a very safe, insulated place if you do have a vehicle that you can sit in.
Yeah. And honestly, I feel like I've cried most in my car in my life. So maybe it would help me get there.
Exactly. Yeah. It feels safe in the car. Like nobody can get to you.
It does. Oh, I relate to this one a lot at the beginning of my journey. I want to go to therapy, but I feel like going means that I've failed. Any advice?
It's so sad when I hear people say that. And I know that a lot of people feel this way. And so I would want everyone to know that going to therapy is really, to me, a preventative act. It's an act of self-care. I have clients that come just because they like to have the space every week to process what's going on. And so it doesn't really have to mean anything except for the fact that you want to go and you want to talk to somebody. And if you're able to accomplish some things while you're there, great.
I think that is the biggest misconception too that I struggled with a lot is it took me actually going to therapy to learn that, oh, it's just someone who kind of helps me know what I know and think what I think, but it can flow here.
Exactly. It's very like clarifying. And also it's just nice to have a space where you can talk about yourself without being interrupted or changing the subject to somebody else. And this person has no skin in the game. Like they just want you to live the life that you want. They're not being impacted by your decisions.
Oh, yes. The next one is, my dad is probably the most toxic person in my life, but I can't ever cut him out of it. What do I do?
I would want to know, like, why do you feel like you can't cut him out of it? And what would that mean to cut him out? Like, is that the only option? Can there be boundaries? I think I have a lot more questions about that one. And going to therapy would probably be really helpful to evaluate the options there.
I agree, because I also saw that permanent mindset too when I read that is, oh, how relatable though. You just feel like I can't.
Exactly. Exactly.
And there's so many things in life where our automatic response is, I can't.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one, I picked this one especially because I got to talk to you today. this person says, I'm a therapist and balancing my clients overwhelms me and my overwhelm is a lot. How can I cope better?
Right. So this is something that I would want to know, like, are you choosing to take on so many clients? Are you working at a job that has unrealistic expectations, sort of like what's driving the burnout? And sometimes it can also be the types of clients that you're taking on or the scheduling. So I go to that first before trying to use any like self-care.
Right.
And then, you know, if it is something that you've got to stay at this job and these are the clients you're working with, then how can we make the overwhelm more manageable? What can you implement in your life to make this sustainable?
Yeah, I really love that when you're responding to this is once again, oh, we can make a change though. It doesn't mean that it's just up to you to fix how you feel about it.
Right, exactly. And so a lot of therapists get into this mindset of like, well, people need me, so I have to see 35 clients a week. And it's like, but when you do, you might not be doing a very good job because you're so burnt out. And so who's really benefiting from this?
Oh, Whitney, you are so amazing. And I can't tell you enough how fangirly I feel about being able to talk to you today.
Thank you. That's really nice of you. And I've loved this as well.
Thank you so much for listening to Therapy Thursday, everyone. Whitney, any last words for our wonderful listeners?
No, this has been a wonderful conversation. If anybody else needs to find me, Instagram is the best place, at Sit With Wit.
The coolest Instagram name ever. And you know what's funny about that is people didn't know that it was Sit With Wit, not Sit With It.
I know. Whenever anybody tries to like insult me, they'll be like, Sit With That. And I'm like,
ew.
Know the name. It's really funny. I've gotten that so many times.
It was
a mean message.
It really blows my mind that anyone would be mean to someone who truly is only helping people. It's just, but anyway, Sit With Wit, so clever. And thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.